Could you first tell me, Mr. Davy, where and when you were born?
Claygate, Surrey, 1913.
What was the date in 1913?
17th of January.
Who were your parents? Who were your parents?
How do you mean, who were they? I mean,
what were the names of your parents?
Oh, Archibald Davy and Amy Ellen Davy.
And what did your father do for a living?
A stock jobber.
Had any of your grandparents been in the city also?
No, my grandfather on that side of the family was a bank manager.
And what did your other grandfather do?
He was a mill owner, a flour mill owner, not a cotton mill, flour mill owner.
Which stock jobbing firm had your father been with?
Well, it was called Davy and Hepworth, and then the Great War came, and then he joined a firm called Lemon Brothers.
Which market had they been jobbing in?
Lemon Brothers dealt in the Kaffir market, the Australian market, oil market in a small way, an industrial market in a small way.
Did your father ever talk about his work at home? Did you ever form much of an impression about what he did when you were young?
Very little.
Did you have any brothers or sisters?
One brother and two sisters.
And what did they do? My
brother was a farmer.
And where did your father send you to school?
When?
Where?
Well, I went to a day school in East Grinstead, Sussex. I then went to a preparatory boarding school in Bournemouth. And then I went to Taunton School.
Did you have any ambitions for yourself while you were at school?
Only to be an engine driver.
And did you try and pursue that?
No, I didn't think there was too much future there. Then I thought about being a farmer, but then I realised there was not enough money to do much about farming, so I thought I'd be a chartered accountant. I passed the preliminary exam for accountancy at a fairly young age. But then I thought it was too much work for me.
How old were you?
16.
And so what?
And then I went to school in Switzerland for 6 months, which I can recommend to anybody. It's far better in my view than going to a university. It broadens everything. And you don't waste time like you do at a university, in my opinion. I mean, if you're going to be a lawyer, doctor, go to university, but not when you're going into the stock exchange. Waste of time.
Had the stock exchange provided your family with a reasonably secure living?
Good question. I would say yes. In the end, yes. But the Great War and the aftermath was very bad for everybody, as you probably know. Well, you're too young to remember. No, but anyway.
So had your father's firms or Lemon Brothers gone through difficult patches?
Well, they all went through a difficult patch. I mean, don't forget, there was apart from the after the war, it was no business, and then you had eventually it was some business, and then you had the 1929 crash, which went on, or the reverberations of that went on for about 3 years, I suppose, maybe four. But luckily, Lemon Brothers was in the gold market, and in the early 30s, the money was being made in the gold market and the gilt-edged market.
What had been the attitude to money in your family? Had they been fairly careful about money?
Well, basically speaking, they didn't have any. I mean, my father was virtually bankrupt in about 1926, and believe it or not, brought up four children on 500 a year. You wouldn't believe that, would you? For about 2 years.
What did you think the attitude was, or do you recall your friends having a view about the city and about the stock market when you were young? When you were at school, for example, did people ever pass comments about the fact that your father was a stock jobber?
I would say no. I would say that in my experience of school, nobody really took anybody any interest of what any parents did, be they farmers or stockbrokers or anybody else. I don't think they were interested in other people's parents in that sense.
What about the city itself? If someone had suggested that they were going to go off to be a broker or a stockbroker, would people have thought that was an acceptable career?
In those days, I don't think school... you're talking about the school?
Yes.
They didn't take, basically speaking, they didn't really take too much interest in what you were going to do when you left school, like I believe they do now. Nobody really discussed it, I don't think.
Well, what were your plans when you had finished your education in Switzerland? Considering a career in
Switzerland? Well, I think my plans then were to go into the stock exchange, because I'd already passed my chartered accountant's preliminary exam, and I told you I thought it was too much work. And I don't know whether I really thought about it, but I'm not a night bird. And I took the view that if you're a chartered accountant or something like that, you'd have quite a lot of work at night. And I think I realized then that I was not a night bird. I'm a morning person. And I think that affected me to a certain extent.
So how did you go about finding a job?
Well, that was, I don't know whether you call it nepotism, but I mean, I just went into my father's firm. He was a partner, and he was very friendly with a senior partner who I got on with, and I just went in, got a job £1 a week as an office boy.
Can you remember when that was?
I can tell you the exact date, the 17th of January 1930, my birthday. My 17th birthday.
How would you describe the firm at that time? Do you have any early memories of the firm, of the partners, the office?
Well, at that time, they were recovering from the 29 crash, and people were beginning to take an interest in South African, mostly South African gold shares, and to a certain extent Australian gold shares, which were a very minor part of the business. So I would say the firm was making a living in 1930.
Were they dealing in any other shares?
Well, I said earlier on, they were dealing in industrials and oils, but not making very much there. Because they were very small in that section anyway.
About how many partners were there?
Well, in those days, partnerships were limited to 20, as you probably know. I'd say they had about 14 partners.
So, within the terms of the time, they were quite a substantial firm.
Oh yes, they were a well-known, well-liked firm.
Were they quite an old firm?
Guessing, I'd say 30 years old. Guessing.
Do you have any recollection about what the offices were like? Were they fairly small or large?
Very small, no lift. Two floors, cramped, not uncomfortable, but cramped.
What were the first jobs they had you doing? You mentioned that you started in the office.
Well, really running around the city with pieces of paper. I mean, every day you had to deliver stock to other people's offices. And then once every, on account day, you had to go around the city and collect checks. So it was really delivering stock, collecting checks, taking bits of paper, letters, messages around the city of London, in the streets of London, well, city really, not London.
And how long were you doing that? Roughly.
I suppose about a year.
And then what did you move on to next?
Well, then I started doing the books. Learning, you know, how to keep a journal, how to keep a ledger, and how the sort of settlement system worked. And another thing one had to do in those days was you had to, I mean, that was later on, you had to, every bargain you did had to be checked. Because, you see, when you do a bargain, I don't know, the situation's all computerized today, but in those days, if you did a bargain, you never wrote a letter. You said, sell you 1,000 shares at a in such and such a company at £1, and wrote it in your own book, and the broker who bought them wrote it in his book. But in case there'd be an accident or a misunderstanding, the broker's representative came to the jobber's representative next day and said, I buy 1,000 XYZ at £1, and the jobber would say, I sell you 1,000. End of story, end of... Well, except for settlement, there was no, you know, contract and all that sent out. I mean, a broker sends a contract note to a client, but the jobber doesn't send a contract note to a broker or vice versa. So I was also on that when I was about 19, I suppose.
Did you have much in the way of office equipment? Or were you fairly simple in...
Well, the big excitement was when we got, after I think I'd been in the firm for a few years, maybe 3 or 4, we had comptometers, which was the beginning, I suppose, of the present sort of computer thing. Mm. We had comptometer, you know, the girls, we had comptometer girls who pressed a lot of buttons like a typewriter. Mm. And of course, they were. See, in the, before that, you might have sold 27 shares to somebody at £4.13/16¼, for example. Well, to multiply, you know, to work out 27 at £4, whatever it is, and a few and a 64th is not exactly easy. You get used to it, but on a comptometer. They just press the buttons and there it is. And I suppose nowadays they press a few more buttons and get the same answer. Mm-hmm. But it, so that was time saving and quite a revolution in the office.
Were they fairly newfangled instruments in those days?
Oh, I think I really can't remember, but I think I think we had a comptometer within the first 2 or 3 years of it sort of coming on the market. Mm-hmm. Can't believe it, can you?
While you were still in the office, I realised that you were still quite young, but did things like the Depression generally affect the atmosphere in the office? Were you conscious about the wider events in the city, or for example, the Hatry crash?
Well, the Hatry crash had took part after I got, just before I got there. And what people don't realise is that the Stock Exchange ran around and produced £1 million to help pay the costs are their own. They didn't have to do it because Hatry was not very honest. But there was another crash, of course, about that time, Kruger and Toll. the Swedish chap, the match, all that business, and he shot himself, and somebody else jumped out, Lernstein jumped out of an aeroplane across the channel. I think that was a bit later, maybe 31, 32. There were quite a lot of things going on then, but I think the people in the office naturally talked about it. But they were, they just, everybody, they were all interested in the firm making money, if they could do, but they all worked hard and sort of took it on the chin. I think human beings are slightly different in those days. Their aspirations weren't as high as they are now.
Well, how did you progress through the office?
Well, I just went through the office. I mean, the intention, the hope was that I'd be good enough to become a partner in the firm at a later time. You see, as I say, it's a form of nepotism, if you like. And after a few years in the office, I suppose I, when I was about 19, I was given what they call a blue button and went on the floor of the stock exchange.
Can you remember your first impressions of the stock exchange? Perhaps not the exact first day, but the early impressions about what the stock exchange was like. Were you happy to be given a blue button, or did you find it a bit nerve-wracking at the beginning?
Well, I was very happy to get a blue button because it was a step up the ladder. You see, in those days, it's probably the same now, you were not allowed to deal until you were 21. And therefore, you had a blue button to allow you on the floor of the stock exchange to be a kind of learner, messenger boy, which is what you were to a large extent. I mean, you were all the day running from one end of the stock exchange to another, leaving messages, either bidding somebody for stock or offering the stock or that sort of thing. And then when you're 21, if you're lucky, you became what they call an authorized clerk and didn't have your blue button. And then if you were lucky and somebody could fork out the money, you became a member. But you don't have to be a member to deal. You probably realize that. But I mean, discipline was different in those days, as you know, perhaps you don't. And therefore, when you're on the stock exchange, you call everybody sir, naturally, and that sort of thing, and if you behaved yourself, so I suppose you weren't nervous exactly, but you knew you had to dress properly and behave properly, in every sense of the word, including the way you spoke to your so-called superiors.
What part of the market did they send you into?
Well, I started off in the CAFA, what was known as the CAFA market. That was the CAFA market is the South African gold share market, as you probably know.
And did you form any early impressions of that market? Were there many jobbers? Was it a very busy market?
In those days, yes. I said earlier on, I mean, in the sort of early 30s, gold shares were very, very popular, and a lot of people, the man in the street, was interested in gold shares rather more than he was in, say, ICI or something, in general terms. So it was a busy market. And, of course, some of the shares, and don't forget, money was different in those days. A lot of shares were sort of 5, 8, and 10 pounds, which nowadays you don't find so many 10-pound shares, about funnily enough. But I mean, now those shares, some of those 10-pound shares in those companies are 50 pounds, inflation. Still going. I mean, the shares that I sort of ran about in are still in going now, 50, 60 years later. I can't tell you the names on without looking at the paper, but there's certainly certain of them going, same gold mines.
Could you describe in a bit more detail the kind of things that you were doing as a blue button? Were you deputed to stand with a particular partner?
Well, you stood near a partner. Don't forget that jobbers mostly stood up all day. Mostly, but there were, some had seats they could sit on when they were tired or weren't. But basically, you did not sit down and do a deal. Well, very exceptionally, if you dealt with somebody who stood up, or you were standing up when he arrived, because he's standing up. So you really, you were, I suppose, you were not allotted to a particular partner, perhaps, unless he was the only one dealing in that particular section. I mean, the Kaffir market had what they called the deep section. That, don't ask me why. The Orange Free State section, yeah, speaks for itself. The finance section, so to speak. So you had one or two partners dealing in the Orange Free State stocks, one or two dealing in the deep levels, and one or two dealing in the finances. So you as a blue button were attached, perhaps, to the Orange Free State section, but you were literally almost touching shoulders with the people who were dealing in the deep. They were very close together. So you weren't, you were basically answerable perhaps to one or two partners, but any partner who was busy would call on you and say, Dick, go over to stand 12 and bid for Driefontein or Ranfontein, bid £20 or whatever they were, £10. So you were really a bit of a dog's body in a way.
When you say go to the stand and bid, is that bit of broker?
Yeah. Well, that's the bit of broker, that's right. I mean, you see, I don't know how much you know about it, but in those days there were stands all around the stock exchange, numbering from one to, my memory is not what it was, it certainly went, I think it went from 1 to 14, if I remember rightly. So, say, Kasnov, you'd find them at stand 2, although they had what they call a box as well. So with Kasnov, you probably didn't go to the stand, you went to their box, which is just outside the stock exchange. But if you went to another firm like, for example, a well-known firm in those days was Gavet. Well, Gavet were at stand 12, I think. So if you go to Gavet at stand 12, so they say go to stand 12 and bid Gavet £10 or whatever. So you took a little note with you, and if there were, you'd call them, and if there was no representative of Gavet there, you left the piece of paper with the waiter. Mm-hmm. Who stood up and sort of, when Gavet's the right chap, gave him the note. That was the sort of thing.
Do you recall whether you enjoyed yourself at this, being a blue button or being in the stock exchange?
The answer to that is, in general terms, I enjoyed it, yes. Very, very much. Great sense of humour. Very human. I mean, am I allowed to tell you a little story of stock exchange humour?
Yes, please.
Well, there were two brothers in the stock exchange who dealt in the rubber market, which before the war was a very busy market. I think a lot of people were gambling rubber shares in, you know, Malaya and all that sort of thing. Well, the war came, and one Frisbee, they both survived the war, and one Frisbee got the Victoria Cross, and the other got a DSO. And after the war, the one who got the DSO was named the Coward, which is stock exchange schoolboy humour. But you see, some would say, oh, I dealt with a coward. Or I dealt with a Victoria Cross, you see. Well, it may sound silly, but that was a sort of humorous story, and it keeps the place going. And so I enjoyed the whole thing.
Do you have any particular memories of experiences as a blue button? I mean, I understand that you're fairly limited in what you could do, and you're still fairly young.
Not really, no. I mean, obviously, you trod on somebody's foot when you're in a hurry and got ticked off by, you know, some older gentleman who was a bit crotchety, give you a ticking off, tell you to behave yourself, but basically speaking, you were well treated by everybody, they knew you got a job to do, and that was it.
Where were you living at the time? Were you still living at home?
I was living at home, yes. I was living in East Grinstead in those days. you know, it's quite, well, of course, mind you, the stock exchange didn't work till 9:30. Well, you didn't really have to get there before about 9:15, even as a junior, basically speaking. But one had to leave East Winston on the 7:30 or something, an hour and a half on the train. But, and also you didn't, most days you didn't work very late, but during the time of Blue Button, on what they call account day, for about 6 months, I worked on Saturday mornings and Sundays, and every other day, about 6 months. And on account day, or not account, a settlement day, shall we say, I used to get a taxi back and stay with somebody in Streatham at 2 o'clock in the morning. So we worked quite hard. So you worked 7 days a week, 6.5 days a week, and one day a fortnight till 2 o'clock in the morning. And most of the days of the week, you left the office about 9 o'clock. So my hours were a 12-hour day.
So were you working a lot harder than you'd originally anticipated?
I probably was. But I wasn't. It wasn't study.
So I take it you were a Blue Button for about 2 years.
I think that's right, yes. And when I became 21, I was made a dealer.
Now, what was involved in that step? How did your work change?
Well, if somebody came to me as a Blue Button and he wasn't a broker and said, what are XYZs? And I could say as a Blue Button, say that the partner or partners were busy. I could say they're 22 and a penny, 8 and 6 pence. He said, thank you very much. And he'd go away. He couldn't deal with me, but he accepted the fact that I knew the price. If I didn't know the price, I'd say, I'm sorry, I don't know. I half an hour ago they were 22 and a penny, 8 and 6 pence, but I don't know what they are. But the point was, it was not a binding price. He was just asking what the price was so he could rush off and tell a client. He couldn't, and he didn't want to wait to speak to the dealer. But when I became a dealer and somebody said, what a so-and-so, and I made 22 and a penny, 8 and 6 pence, I committed myself, basically. And he'd say, sell you 2,000 or he might not, that's what I laid myself open to, if you see what I mean, or you could buy them. So I became a dealer, and my price meant something on which he could deal.
Now, which book were you working on when you did become a dealer?
Well, I was, by that time, I was with my father in the Australian market. And so when I started dealing, I'd spent couple of years in the CAFA market. When I was a dealer, I was put into the Australian market.
And how many of you were on that book?
Well, in those days, there were only two partners and myself. Well, I mean, I was a dealer, so I'd say three. But I mean, you dealt in other things like, not only Australians, I mean, we dealt a thing called Yukon Consolidated, which is a gold trading proposition in Alaska, in the Yukon, which I think is Alaska, isn't it? And, you know, Mountain Copper, which was based in San Francisco, so you had a fairly wide sort of spread of interest. But there were three dealers, two partners and myself.
Was it a very big market? Were there several jobbers?
In those days, some people call it the Australian market, and some people call it the miscellaneous mining market. I suppose it was called the miscellaneous mining market. of which the Australian section was a section of it, because in those days there was a tin market, tin mines, you see, in Malaysia particularly. I mean, that's all died away now. Malaysian tins, in fact, Cornish tins. So there was the, and then there was sort of gold mine in Venezuela. That's another thing. I don't know. I don't think it ever was a gold mine, but we thought there was.
So you were dealing in the shares of this company that was set up as a gold market, a gold mining.
Yes. Well, in fact, to be fair, I mean that there was a hole in the ground, but I think they did produce some gold. But you know, it was sort of wasn't very successful, so I put it that way. I don't think, in my experience, I have ever dealt in a thing which really didn't exist, which has happened in the history of the Stock Exchange, but I think those days are over before the First World War.
Did you feel ready to become authorised?
Oh, I think so, yes. I was very confident. Mm.
And how did the book actually work? There were the two partners and you were the junior. Were you given your own stocks to deal in?
Good point. Well, I was given about four stocks to deal in, for which I was sort of given responsibility,